From Wondery, I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And this is Even the Rich. Over the last four episodes, we've been singing to you about the rise of Jay-Z and Beyoncé. They made music and babies. They started businesses and became billionaires. And they never gave up on their marriage, even when the going got tough.
We covered so much, Brooke, but I'm still left with this question. Is there anything Jay and Beyoncé can't do? That's why I wanted to talk to Zach O'Malley Greenberg. He's a senior editor at Forbes magazine, and he's also the author of Empire State of Mind, How Jay-Z Went From Street Corner to Corner Office. It's a book we relied on while we were researching this series, and Zach leaves no stone unturned. Like, you know how we talked about the champagne label Jay bought?
Yeah, of course.
Well, Zach actually went to France to see the cellars with his own two eyes.
Oh my God, jealous.
Yeah, same. We had a great conversation about what Jay-Z and Beyoncé learned from each other in order to grow their empires together. We also talked about how, in the last few years, the two of them have emerged as leading advocates in the fight for social justice. And can I just say, as a woman of color, I've really enjoyed learning about all the ways Jay and Beyoncé have used their voice to speak out on all of the racial injustices in this country.
Yeah, I can't wait to listen.
Hi, Zach. It's so great to talk to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's jump right in. You've written several books, but Empire State of Mind was your first. Can you walk me through how that book came about?
It was a strange occurrence, really. An editor reached out to me and she said, would you like to write a book about Jay-Z or Diddy? And I said, yes. it was one of the easiest questions I've ever had to answer. So we just kind of went from there and, it was kind of deciding, okay, are we going to do Jay-Z or are we going to do Diddy? And it's like, well, I think we should do Jay-Z right now. There are a few reasons behind that, but, you know, I think part of it was that Jay-Z was musically relevant in a way that Diddy wasn't.
How much did you know about Jay-Z going into this book?
Well, you know, I grew up in New York, so I was always listening to hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
There was no one, is no one bigger than Jay-Z in New York, really anywhere. In terms of following the business, when I first got to Forbes in 2007 full-time, editor came to my cubicle and she said, you're under 30, do you like hip-hop? And I said, yes. And she said, do you want to help me put together the first ever list of the top earning rappers? And I said, yes, yes, yes. So I ended up writing a story about Tupac Shakur and how he was making more money dead than all but five living rappers. And then a few of the living rappers we identified as the hip-hop cash kings. The cream of the crop there were Jay-Z, 50 Cent, and Diddy. I always remember I was out in New Mexico reporting a different story, and I had the radio on all of a sudden. I hear, Forbes, 1, 2, 3. I get money. And it was Jay-Z and 50 Cent and Diddy, and they'd recorded this remix called the Billion Dollar Remix, and in which they shouted out Forbes and Forbes.com and the magazine and all this stuff. And so I got back to the office and everybody was like, whoa, man, holy, whoa, we're really onto something here. And that was kind of, for me, the beginning of covering the business of hip hop.
It's interesting, talking about the title of your book and how it's, you know, Jay-Z's lyrics. He's so autobiographical, I feel like. What did you learn about his life and his business ventures from his songs? Because he like talks about them through his music, which is just wild to me.
It's amazing to me, you know, over the course of writing the book, one of the things I found is a lot of superstars embellish. And, you know, I think in particularly some types of hip hop, you know, that's kind of part of the art form. You know, Jay-Z's not without his embellishment, but I mean, more or less the things that he says are true. You know, he speaks from his personal experience. So although he didn't talk to me for the book, it was kind of fascinating as I went and talked to people who were around him and listened to his old stuff, you know, over and over again, could kind of start to see some of the evidence bearing out, you know, some of those stories and, you know, really kind of come to believe a lot of the stuff that he says on the records.
Speaking of talking to different people in his life, what was the most interesting thing that you learned about him, or what surprised you the most?
You know, I mean, Jay-Z, somebody who puts off this image as being very self-assured and confident and totally in charge and in command of everything. But the more people I talked to, the clearer the picture emerged of somebody who, although confident, was not afraid to ask questions and was keenly aware of what he didn't know, and really made it his mission to really dig into some of the things that he didn't completely understand. And I sort of call him like a hermit crab. He would go and he would take these little nuggets of information and add them to his own shell, and just kind of amass this bigger and bigger shell of wisdom and sort of business lessons, you know, with which to proceed.
Yeah, and I feel like there's something ironic there, right? That humility, because a lot of his songs are about how he is God MC, the greatest rapper of all time. But as a businessman, he's not afraid to ask questions. He's not afraid to admit when he's wrong or doesn't know something.
You know, I think that up until pretty recently, Jay-Z wasn't so interested in ever admitting that he was wrong about anything. And there was really this attitude of win at all costs. And he says on the Blueprint, I will not lose ever. And I think one of the challenges of writing the book was, how do you humanize somebody who has this invincible aura? The way that Jay initially treated mistakes was just to sweep them under the rug.
You argue that Jay-Z's professional success is tied to his, quote, innate talents honed through hustling. Can you describe a little bit about how his early life shaped his eventual success?
I would say that Jay learned supply and demand. He learned economics, you know, firsthand at a pretty young age. And I actually interviewed some of the people who he worked with on the hustling side of things and got a pretty good sense of the way that the drug economy worked in the late 80s and early 90s. And, you know, pretty much you knew somebody at JFK, you know, you had a cousin at Customs, as he says, who'd get shit through, or whatever the case may be. You know, you would take the product further and further south to Jersey, to Maryland, where there was less supply, more demand. And so Jay-Z followed the economics. When you go back to Reasonable Doubt and listen to some of the lyrics, you know, those are all based on his experience. And, you know, that was pretty real.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay. Well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look, and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh, yeah. The Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned-out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes. When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss. Yeah. And so mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listen on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen, and you know I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah, new members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500 to get started.
In your book, you compare Jay-Z to Martha Stewart and Oprah, folks who turned their personal brand into professional success. Can you pinpoint the moment when Jay-Z realized he was more than just an artist, that he was the brand of Jay-Z?
Jay-Z realized from the beginning that he was a brand, and he kind of had to be because in the mid-90s, when he was first shopping Reasonable Doubt as a record, he went to all the record labels and tried to get a record deal, but they weren't interested. You know, the subject matter was a little too risky, they thought, especially in light of things that had been going on. You know, that was a period of time with the whole East Coast, West Coast thing that labels were starting to be afraid of, you know, what they viewed as this sort of like violence that was unique to hip hop, and they got scared and were not so interested. So it resulted in Jay-Z having to start his own label. You know, once he started Rockefeller with Kareem Biggs Burke and Damon Dash, it became pretty clear that, you know, that this idea of controlling their own destiny and, you know, having this label, like, that was sort of a branding exercise in itself. Even though it was an entrepreneurialism out of necessity, it became this huge asset and a way to build equity in the financial sense. The Rockefeller brand spawned pretty quickly. Rockaware, the clothing line, Armadale Vodka was something that happened. I think Jay-Z, you know, from the get-go, knew that he was more than just a rapper.
Well, and that's one of the things that really impresses me about him, is that it feels like nothing is outside of his comfort zone. He's just as happy running a record label as he is having a champagne label. And I feel like that's pretty unusual. I mean, I don't think someone like Steve Jobs was making wine while he was running Apple.
Jay-Z has this line, I sell ice in winter, fire in hell. I'm a hustler, baby. I'll sell water to a well. And, you know, just it kind of goes to show his attitude. He's a salesman, right? And, you know, it's sort of like you see executives on the sales side bounce from, you know, Pepsi to, I don't know, Unilever or something, you know, so they go from selling beverages to selling laundry detergent, or it doesn't really matter. They're just selling you something. And I think there's that element to him, but he also wants to build something, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think a great example of that is Iceberg. So the clothing line, he used to shout out Iceberg in some of his songs. And so he and Damon Dash met with the owners of the brand, and, you know, they wanted to have some kind of endorsement deal or maybe some kind of equity deal, and they were basically laughed out of the room and you know, were told, like, you can have some free shirts if you want, but that's about it. So Jay-Z decided, you know, we'll forget that. We'll do our own, and we'll really build out this Rockaware thing. That was the light bulb moment where he realized, like, I could just rap about brands randomly and give free advertising to other people, or I could create my own things and rap about them instead. Kind of have my cake and eat it too. And so that's been his, right, with champagne and...
It's genius.
You know, a basketball team. Yeah, exactly. I think his scope of things to own, or, you know, to have a business interested in, are really only limited by the scope of what he could rap about, you know, which is quite wide.
So obviously not all of his business ventures did work out. And one of the more interesting failures, in my opinion, that you write about in your book is the Jay-Z Jeep. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
The Jay-Z Jeep was this concept that was being kind of workshopped in the late aughts. And, you know, but it was a different world back then. And I think hip hop was still having trouble getting traction with mainstream brands because of what had happened in the late 90s and, you know, with Biggie and Tupac and the sort of like association of hip hop and violence. And so there was this idea being tossed around between Jay-Z's people and a guy by the name of MC Search, who was in the group Third Base and had gone to Detroit and was working in the auto industry. The idea was to go team up with a company that I believe it was Mopar, which is part owned by Chrysler, and they were going to put out a Jay-Z edition Jeep. Like, they had this model called the Jeep Commander, which was sort of like a Jeep Cherokee on steroids. They were going to do a special, you know, like how they have Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer, right, or they have, you know, the Harley Davidson edition Ford F-150. They were going to do a Jay-Z Jeep. It was going to be Jay-Z blue, like a special patented color, sort of this like metallic blue, mm-hmm. With, you know, buttercream leather interior and a special sound system and all this stuff. You know, it was very much in the works, but basically in my interviews with MC Search, what I learned was that it had been kiboshed and it wasn't exactly clear what happened, but Search believed that, you know, ultimately the executives, the auto executives who would have been responsible for greenlighting it, just felt it was too risky to be attaching a wrapper to their product, and so it never came to fruition. But you did see, actually, you know, one thing come out of it, which is Jay-Z ended up at an auto show, and he hopped out of this, like, blue, I think it was a Denali. The car was painted Jay-Z blue, and it was supposed to be this, like, maybe he didn't get his own, you know, model of car, but, you know, the color, this Jay-Z blue, was going to be something that you could paint any car or any, you know, whatever, and had their patent or their copyright or whatever it was, but it just never really caught on.
When you say too risky, let's unpack that. Part of it, right, is that they were nervous about Jay-Z's past, his criminal activity, and you have to wonder about if any of that was about the color of his skin, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it certainly was an issue of race. And so many times, you know, when these deals get turned down in the past, it's blah, 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 it's this and that and hip-hop, and, you know, sort of like hip-hop becomes a proxy word for race. And
yeah,
like a convenient way of racist executives, you know, blaming something external on why they're turning somebody down.
Can you think of other times when Jay-Z, the businessman, came face-to-face with institutional racism like that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think going back to the very beginning when Jay-Z was shopping his albums to these label heads, I mean, even today, if you look at the executive ranks, the music business, I think it's only 8% black if you look at the executive ranks. So, you know, I mean, that's insane. It's not even representative of, you know, the makeup of the country, but it's certainly not representative of the makeup of, you know, of what music sells, right? I mean, if you hip-hop is the most consumed genre in the world, and I mean, something like 30% market share, and then, you know, if you think about how deeply hip-hop has now become ingrained into pop and how much it's influenced other genres, I think certainly the fact that Jay-Z didn't get those deals, you know, to begin with in the record industry, there's a degree of institutionalized racism that had to have been a part of it. And certainly, you know, you see him over the years starting his own clothing line or his own champagne. There were some pretty explicit instances of bias that he was reacting against when it comes to the champagne. Yeah. There was this infamous quote by the guy who was in charge of Cristal, and somebody from The Economist asked him what he thought about all these rappers talking about Cristal champagne, and he said, well, we can't forbid them from buying it, you know, like as though he might have wanted to if he could have. And so,
yeah,
you know, Jay seized on that immediately and said, I'm not going to be consuming Cristal or rapping about it or selling it in my clubs. And what a great way to react, right? Like, to turn such a negative into such a positive, and to kind of change the conversation around. And it's a very Jay-Z thing, right? It's like, well, here's a horrible societal thing. I'm going to boycott it and then make money off of the thing that I create to replace it. So it's pretty genius.
When you find new ways to save, you can reach your financial goals more easily and still have the occasional treat.
Exactly. And Chime's here to help you do that. With a Chime checking account, you can make financial progress with features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe, or getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit.
Yep. So if you set up direct deposit into your Chime account and use an activated debit card, Chime will spot you up to your limit when you exceed your balance.
And I love that Chime never charges fees or interest for using SpotMe. To date, Chime has spotted members over $20 billion.
My God. Take more control of your finances and say goodbye to monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/rich. That's chime.com/rich.
Chime feels like progress.
Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Boosts are available to eligible Chime members enrolled in SpotMe and are subject to monthly limits. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
We all face stress in our daily lives. What if the answer to a better stress response is in one key nutrient? I'm talking about magnesium, and specifically Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse low levels of magnesium, which could have a positive effect on our stress response. But don't take my word for it. Here's a quote from a 2020 issue of the scientific journal Nutrients. Results suggest that stress could increase magnesium loss, causing a deficiency. And in turn, magnesium deficiency could enhance the body's susceptibility to stress, resulting in a magnesium and stress vicious circle. I only recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. It's the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress resilience and better sleep. Simply go to bioptimizers.com/ifstories. Promo code IFSTORIES10 to get your magnesium breakthrough and find out this month's gift with purchase. That's bioptimizers.com/IFSTORIES. Promo code IFSTORIES10.
We talked a little bit earlier about, you know, Jay-Z using his lyrics, specifically the 99 Problems. You're going to need a warrant for that. I feel like in recent years, especially, he's become a leading voice for social justice. For example, the Reform Alliance, which was the criminal justice reform initiative he created with Meek Mill. And then in the last few weeks, with everything going on in this country, we've seen him take a stand against the police brutality and racism that has prompted the protests that are happening everywhere. Can you talk about some of the things he's done on that front?
Jay-Z has been incredibly active and has now been one of the leading voices, you know, I think, in terms of civil rights, human rights, and, you know, however you want to cast it. But, you know, I think that as recently as 5 or 6 years ago, there was this sentiment of, like, we wish Jay would do more because he has such a huge platform. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just not doing enough. In a matter of about 5 years, completely reversed that reputation. Some of the work he's been doing with Meek Mill, some of the, you know, massive donations he's been giving to, you know, to various relief organizations, advocacy groups, you know, both from COVID to the protests in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. You know, I think he's now become somebody who is looked at as, you know, instead of sort of lagging or being silent, you know, he's very prominent, and I think Beyonce increasingly so as well.
Yeah, and you know, some of his efforts as an advocate have attracted some criticism. As I'm sure you know, last summer he entered into that partnership with the NFL, the idea being that he would be the face of the league's social justice efforts. But the deal was met with quite a lot of backlash. Can you talk a little bit about what happened there?
You know, in linking up with the NFL, you know, it gives them a little bit of cover, and I think a lot of people, you know, rightly recognize that they shouldn't be getting that cover. On the other side of it, right, you got to look at it, at least in some way, there's the thought that, you know, Jay is getting a seat at the table, and there is not a single black owner in the NFL, even though the majority of the players are, and you know, in order to become, to truly enact change, it's about being in the room where it happens, and if Jay could be there, he could do more from inside the machine than, you know, from pushing on the outside, and you know, perhaps the goal there would be to eventually own a team, to have a kind of a say in what goes on at the NFL. And you got to think that things would be different if the composition of ownership were different. But you know, is it a step in the right direction, or is it selling out? You know, I think it, I guess it's in the eye of the beholder. But it's been interesting to see how, you know, sort of the NFL has been walking back its stance on Colin Kaepernick taking a knee in the wake of all the protests, and makes you wonder if Jay-Z, you know, had some role behind the scenes in making that happen.
We're coming to the end, but I would be remiss if we didn't touch on Beyonce when we talk about Jay-Z, obviously. You write, and I'm going to quote you here, Jay-Z and Beyonce seem to be excellent role models for each other career-wise. Can you give some examples of that?
One of the things that differentiated the way that they went about the financial side of their career historically was that Beyonce took more cash deals and Jay-Z did more equity deals. The longer they're together, the more you see Beyonce doing equity deals and building that kind of long-term generational wealth. I mean, I guess they have generational wealth, you know, like a level of wealth that will be passed on to their, you know, to their great-grandkids. So they're fine there no matter what. But, you know, some of the things that she's been doing, from investing in early in Uber, her Ivy Park line, and having ownership there, you know, those are very Jay-style moves. And at the same time, I think he's recognized that although ownership is incredibly important, sometimes you get a really good kind of a cash deal and you should probably take it. And, you know, I think certainly on the touring front, since he's been with Beyonce, he signed a couple of just mammoth deals with Live Nation that encompass everything from touring to being kind of an umbrella home to Rock Nation, you know, to sort of the thought that, it's definitely great to own your own business, but, you know, you also take on a lot of risk if you're doing it by yourself, whereas if you're taking other people's money, you know, you can, you know, there's less of a downside there.
Yeah. So Beyonce and Jay-Z are one of the great American love stories now. Why do you think their marriage has such a hold over the popular attention?
They're not perfect, and they've increasingly been open about their imperfections, you know, as individuals and in their relationship. And, you know, I think people are always going to be, you know, there will always be some level of interest in the lifestyles of the rich and famous. But, you know, at some point, if it's just, you know, everything is peachy keen and we're hanging out, you know, by the beach sipping mojitos, I mean, whenever we want, that's maybe not as interesting to some people and to most people. Versus when you start to have, you know, kind of like real life issues that are coming up and that are being confronted and addressed, and, you know, people see that and maybe they see a reflection of themselves and maybe, you know, how they could work through some of that. It's pretty unprecedented that we've had, you know, a relationship of sort of this profile, that's lasted this long, where the, you know, it's been this public and sort of, you know, there's been at times extreme privacy, but also at times like extreme openness. And so this kind of push and pull, you know, like these very intimate glimpses into their relationship. You know, I think people just, you know, they kind of want to see what's happening next. And they want, you know, not just for sort of like the soap opera element, but because increasingly they feel like maybe they could in some way relate it to their own life.
Yeah, definitely. I feel that as one of the many that is very into Beyonce and Jay-Z news.
Yeah, sure.
So, Zach, that's all I have for today. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you feel like we should have covered when it comes to Jay-Z and Beyonce?
The thing that has been on my mind a lot lately is the word equity. And one of the things that Jay-Z has been so good about is preaching the values of ownership, whether it's a car or a home or a business, and, you know, having financial equity in, you know, the parts of your everyday life and also your working life to the extent that you can, and to view that as this key to creating the sort of generational wealth that is going to ultimately, you know, solidify equity in terms of the societal sense. So I think that word is really important in every facet. And I think that Jay-Z, perhaps earlier in his career, is focused on the financial side. he's now also becoming increasingly fixated on the societal side. And, you know, I think you're not going to have kind of like true equity in any sense of the word until, you know, both of those sides are married. Equity on the financial side, yeah, I mean ownership. And on the social side, equity, I mean more tied to equality and,
right.
You know, parity and fairness when it comes to, you know, the way that our system treats everybody.
Yeah. These are great points. I'm really glad that you brought them up. Thank you for giving me your time, talking to me about your book and about Jay-Z and Beyonce. I loved the read, and I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Likewise. Glad to hear it. I'm working on the next edition.
Ooh.
I'll have it wrapped up by the end of the summer. So.
All right, Zach, thank you so much for your time.
You bet.
From Wondery, this is the very last episode of our series, Jay-Z and Beyonce, American Royalty. Thanks again to Zach O'Malley Greenberg. His book, Empire State of Mind, is available everywhere books are sold. Next week, I'm taking the mic so I can blow your minds with a totally bonkers story. What happens when an heir to one of the greatest family fortunes of all time is kidnapped and no one wants to pay his ransom?
Juicy. I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore Williams. This episode was produced by Lee Hernandez. Our associate producer is Caleb Bissinger. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Marsha Louie, and Hernan Lopez. For Wondery.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig. Inspiring kid confidence.